Welcome to the Addendum, folks. Three great sponsors this week: Blue Apron, Audible, and Mack Weldon. Hey, Audible, 30-day free trial and one free book. All you got to do is go to www.audible.com/undisclosed. Listen in for the spots later in the show. Until then, enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer. I'm back, and this is the podcast about all things undisclosed. Now, if you're listening to this addendum, it's probably because you, like me, are already knee-deep in Season 2 of Undisclosed. In Episode 7, Unusual Suspects, the team examined all the possible perpetrators that the Rome police considered in the murder of Isaac Dawkins on Highway 27 on that night in Georgia in January of 2000. These are all the people that they crossed off their list, all the roads not taken. With us today are Susan Simpson and Colin Miller, hosts of Undisclosed. Susan Simpson blogs at viewfromll2.com, and she's an associate at the Volkov Law Group. How you doing, Susan?
Good. I feel like I should change my intro now, because I used to view at LL2.
Okay.
I've less had time to actually blog there, but...
Former blogger at the View from LL2. People will be sad about the retirement of that particular website. But thank you for being here, Susan. We also have Colin Miller, who's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. He blogs at Evidence Prof. And thanks for being here, Colin.
Yeah, welcome back, John. Look forward to talking about this episode with you.
We also have a very special guest, Allison Sweeney, who is, as many of you know, the host of The Biggest Loser. She's been on Days of Our Lives for, I believe, decades. She currently films and produces TV movies for Hallmark Channel and Hallmark Movies and Mysteries. And she's also busy writing novels and being a mom, all those things. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm super excited.
Now, Allison, I ask this of all the new people on the show. What brought you to Undisclosed? What spurred your interest?
I think probably like a lot of people, I started listening to Serial obsessive compulsively and then had to know more and caught on to Undisclosed from there and Truth and Justice. And my husband's like, oh no, again with the podcasting, you just don't stop. I'm like, I can't. I have to know what happened. I was live tweeting, listening to the PCR hearing. And then of course this new season has just caught me up again. And you guys are awesome. I love what you do. I feel like I'm learning so much. And I love that too. You know, I like you're my professor, Colin, and I like study. And it's like, there should be a test coming up for me.
Now, have you developed coping strategies like I do? I double the speed on listening to the podcast, and I do it when I drive. I do it when I'm in the bathroom. And again, I don't know if your spouse thinks you're having an affair or not.
It's hard because I at first was listening with earbuds, and then as I like cleaned up or whatever, and then it became more like, no, I need to hear the whole thing. So I have noise-canceling headphones that I listen to, and now my whole family, I have to like give them the one finger, like hold on gesture, and I pause it. Like I can't miss one word. It's very serious.
That's hardcore.
Yeah, I'm not kidding around.
We're going to take a short break now to check in with one of our regular and favorite sponsors, and that is Audible.com. You've heard of Audible before, but I have to drive this point home. If you are a podcast listener, and I know we have millions of them, almost 2 million per episode, in fact, that's a lot of podcast listeners, you will love audiobooks because you like hearing your content and information. And there's nobody across the internet that can match Audible's content when it comes to a selection of audiobooks, audio shows, news, comedy, and all kinds of things from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and even magazine and newspaper publishers. And I probably don't have to tell you that it's in every genre imaginable. So whether you like history, nonfiction, romance, and of course, true crime, it's all there. I'm going to recommend the same book I've been recommending for a few weeks now, and that is my book, A Non-Story. And you can actually listen to it for free because Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. So what you have to do is go to audible.com/undisclosed, go through all the different audio programs. Maybe you don't want A Non-Story, but you know what? It's been topping the charts on Audible ever since we launched a few weeks ago, and I've been getting incredible reviews on the narration. So I think you'll enjoy it. And you can get a free title of your choice. It's that easy. It's audible.com/undisclosed. Sign up, 30-day trial, and get whatever book you want. And if you pick a non-story, I would love to hear back from you online. Let me know what you think of it. You're not going to hear just, obviously, the whole investigative aspect of this case, but you're also going to hear me read Adnan's letters, his own contributions to the book, and tell you about the backstories that you've never heard before. And believe me, a lot of folks are contacting me, say, hey, listen, I listen to Serial, I listen to everything of Undisclosed, I've read everything I can, and yet I got so much out of this book. There's so much there I never knew. So I hope you take advantage of this offer and go in and pick a non-story as your free audiobook. Once again, it is audible.com/undisclosed. Sign up for your trial membership today.
So just to give a little recap of where Adnan Syed's case is right now, is as you'd probably heard, Judge Martin Welch has vacated the ruling convicting him of the murder of Haemin Lee. And after that ruling was made public, the state attorney general let people know that they would be appealing that ruling. So the state's attorney general did in fact appeal. And in that appeal, they did something interesting. They mentioned that if the attorneys for Adnan were to cross appeal, that being appeal another aspect of the ruling in order to keep it in place, that he would be introducing some new evidence, that of two sisters who refute the alibi claim that Asia McLean has made on Adnan's behalf. So as it turns out, Justin Brown, the defense attorney for Adnan Syed, has in fact filed a cross appeal. So as of last Monday, the Office of Attorney General of Maryland filed an application of a limited remand in the Adnan Syed case. And I have no idea what that is. Colin, could you chime in on what exactly that is?
Yeah, basically the attorney general wants to send the case back down to Judge Martin Welch once again so that they can enter evidence of these two sisters who they claim will, in essence, blow up Aza's alibi by saying that back in 1999 she said because she thought Adnan was innocent, she decided she'd make up an alibi to support that case even though it wasn't legitimate.
So he's asking that they not, the Court of Special Appeals, not listen to this particular appeal and send it back?
Right, because the Court of Special Appeals can't receive new evidence. That's why initially they sent the case back down in the first place to have Asia and the other witnesses testify. So now the state is saying, despite the fact we had every opportunity, like the defense, to present our best evidence, we didn't have these sisters. So we want you to send the case back down again so that now Judge Welch can hear from these sisters and maybe reconsider his opinion.
But my understanding is that appellate courts aren't supposed to consider new evidence anyway. So it seems like they're saying, okay, don't consider the appeal. Just forget about that it was filed at all. If I sound confused, it's because I am.
I was going to say, if I may, in my completely uneducated place here, I don't understand how they get to make that argument that they should get these two sisters who, like, where have they been for 20 years? And then Adnan's attorney doesn't get to bring up Tina and all of those issues with her incompetency and her health. I don't understand how that's different.
Yeah, it's a great point. And actually, the state really doesn't have a leg to stand on because there's a case out of Maryland. It's the Alston case. And it says, we're concerned about defendants who are wrongfully convicted. So we, as a special dispensation, will allow in rare cases for defendants to reopen post-conviction review proceedings to present new evidence. And that's why the cell tower evidence was presented. That's why Asia was allowed to testify. But in that case, they specifically say we do not afford that same dispensation to the state. So you're exactly right for the state to argue we should be given this right that the defendants are given, especially when Adnan was limited in what he could present. It's not really an argument that's going to hold water. It's not really a legal strategy. It's more PR than anything.
So it would seem that it's a strategy just to get the affidavits of these two sisters out in the public eye and discussed in terms of the case. But it seems like the affidavits are self-contradictory. It doesn't seem to make sense that at one point they state that they didn't understand that she was so into this case, but they also state that they argued about it all the way back when the case first occurred. So which is it? If you didn't know, then why are you arguing about it?
The way Theroux is trying to play it off is that, first of all, they didn't actually know that Asia went ahead and sent her letters. They apparently assumed that their arguments were so good in class that day that Asia gave up this whole plan and the end. But what happened was in November, I think probably like right after episode one or two of Serial in 2014, one of the sisters sent a message on Facebook to Asia saying, I had no idea you were involved like that back then. Here's a link to the show. Just a friendly seeming message. So what Theroux argues now is that this was an attempt to call out Asia or to sort of seek a reaction. As in, this affiant was trying to bait Asia into like admitting that she lied or something. But that's not what the letter is at all saying.
And also the notes, again, contradict themselves because there's no way that Asia could have known at that time that that particular point in time would be so important to the case. So, and she also says, supposedly at that time, she says, I'm going to lie a little to prove him innocent because I think he's innocent. But if he's proven guilty, well, then he must be guilty. That, of course, doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. When all the news articles out at that time said it was 3 p.m. that Hay left school, why is Asia trying to lie to make an alibi to prove it non-innocent? And she very specifically makes it before the murder could have occurred, based on everything she knew.
Well, and at that time, the murder could have happened at any time. I mean, it's such a terrible thing to imagine, but there's really not anything to validate, especially with the lividity evidence, right? There's nothing really that says concretely that she died that day. At the time, especially, they didn't know. They didn't find her for a month.
Yeah, I'm just baffled because you file an appeal, but now you're saying, don't consider this appeal, send it back. You know, it seems a very twisted legal maneuver. Yeah.
And if you read the actual exchanges between everyone, between the sisters and Asia, it's not what Theer was trying to portray it as. I mean, I read Theer's brief first. The way he describes the Facebook exchange between Sister One and Asia was as if Asia responded angrily or sarcastically said, okay, honey, I haven't forgotten what you told me. And that's how I read it in the brief. That's what I thought that Asia's response meant, because that's the way he portrays it. But then you look at the actual letters, and what happens is that after Sister One sends a link to Serial and says, wow, I had no idea, Asia waits about a month, and then after Christmas, she writes back and said, sorry it took so long to get back to you. I've been so busy, but look what I found. And she sends this generic high school girl into senior year letter full of like, stay sweet, love you like a sister. The crap everyone wrote back then. And it's clearly Asia being like, hey, I was thinking of you. Here's this cute letter you sent me back in 1999. And that's it. And then now Theo's here trying to portray it as if Asia is like snapping back at the sister for catching her in a lie.
His misrepresentation of everything that was written down in that PCR hearing is preposterous. I feel like that was his whole game, was to spin things on every level.
Kind of succeeded in a way, though, because it was his attack. So one of his big arguments at the hearing was that Asia had to be lying because her letter says, I got to go to third period now. So he had this huge tirade about how, of course, Asia's lying. Why would she possibly have said that she was going to third period when she did not go to third period during this time period? She went to her after school job work thing. So she didn't have a class then and she's lying. And so Asia, after the hearing, which you can see from the messages to other girls, is that she's trying to reconfirm what happened back then, because she thought she went to a third period, and now she's in court, and this prosecutor's telling her, nope, you didn't have a third period, you're a liar. And she's like, well, am I a liar or what? So she goes through her photos, finds a photo of her in third period with one of the sisters, and then writes to them and says, hey, we had third period together, right? We went there after second period until we were released to go to our work study stuff. And the girls write back, yep, that's what happened. And they are now arguing, the girls are saying that Asia writing to them about that was because she was confirming they knew that she lied.
Yeah, so I read some of those interactions and they just seemed to me like she was trying to confirm her memory. It read much more innocently than it's portrayed in the briefing. So in terms of this filing, of course, a lot of people are wondering, does this have any real possibility of success? I mean, it's a very unusual request.
So what happens next is Justin is cross-appealed. He still needs to file his opposition to the state's appeal. And my odds, I place them less than 1%. The Maryland precedent's clear. The state cannot file a motion to reopen. The Alston case says they can't file a motion to reopen. And the case, there's one case cited by Theo in his brief, and it doesn't support his position at all. So there's pretty much no way the Court of Special Appeals is going to send this back down again. They're going to decide either to take the appeal or not. It's not going back for more evidence.
So it'll be based on how that particular Martin Welch ruling came down. They won't be introducing any new things.
Right. They are stuck with the record as it exists. There's not going to be any new evidence on either side to either support or rebut the claim of ineffective assistance.
And for those of us who just need to hear it again, how long does something like that take? I know that that question came up a lot, but it just continues to baffle me. And he's sitting there, not guilty at this point, still in prison. So
yeah, there's no prescribed deadline for the Court of Special Appeals either to deny or give leave to appeal. I would guess to look for an opinion probably in the next 2 or 3 months.
Colin, have you read through the rest of the brief?
Yeah.
I mean, what did you think about the arguments? Not even the arguments, but the factual representations that Theer makes throughout of it.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Allison just brought up a minute ago, and I blogged about it yesterday, is Thiru promised at the hearing that Officer Steve would say Adnan was not at the library on January 13th, and you saw when he testified, he said something very different. He said that Billy Martin would testify that Christina Gutierrez acted reasonably in her handling of the alibi issue. That witness was never called. There was Chad Fitzgerald, who was supposed to rebut the AT&T disclaimer. And as I said in my post, his testimony sort of went over like the Hindenburg. And it's this constant pattern of Thiru over-promising and under-delivering. And you just really can't trust anything that's written in these briefs. And I think both of you have mentioned reading through it and saying it's completely different the way he represents it as opposed to when you actually go to the source documents. And so it's really troubling the way that the state is currently making certain assertions.
Is he supposed to be championing for the state, like, to any lengths, do anything you can, convince anyone of anything? Or is he supposed to be defending, knowing that that's not the law and you're not supposed to misrepresent things like that?
In real life, most attorneys have something in them that makes them not write blatantly factually untrue things and feel comfortable doing it. Thiru does not have whatever that is. He repeatedly has, throughout the course of this litigation and previous cases, he just has no problem presenting something that is factually untrue and just carrying on as if nothing happened. For instance, at the PCR hearing, he is telling the court, I have my notes, he did argue to the court in his closing that Asia had to be a liar because she read about going to third period and third period didn't happen. Well, of course, that's not true. And now that he has these witnesses that say they heard a confession that Asia lied in third period, he's happy to say there was a third period after all. But like, let's take what Colin just mentioned about Officer Steve. Everyone knows that Thiru is not telling the truth in his brief when he writes that they only called Officer Steve to prove what Wackenhut was. No one's fooled by that. No one out there reading this brief thinks that Thiru is not lying when he says that, because Thiru clearly called Steve for two purposes. One, to say that there were no cameras in the library, therefore Asia's a liar. And two, that Adnan's attorneys talked to Steve, who told them that Adnan was lying because he was not in the library on January 13th. So despite the fact that the truth is obvious, Thiru goes ahead and writes in his brief, I only called Officer Steve because I just wanted him to say what Wackenhut really was. And that's the security company he worked for.
Why would that be material?
Why would you bring your one fact witness in the whole hearing? Oh, can you define Wackenhut for us?
It's a painfully obvious tactic. But again, the point that Allison seemed to be making is he seems to be trying harder than usual to do this. And I can only guess at this point it is to appear to win the case in the court of public opinion in some respect, you know, because it doesn't sound like he's going to win in the actual court.
That pretty much sums it up perfectly. It's an appeal to the public opinion as opposed to the Court of Special Appeals, which is pretty much going to look at this and reject it out of hand.
It just breaks my heart for Hayes' family that they listen to that. I don't know where they must be coming from and how hard this must be for them to drag it all out again, but to not know who really did it. I mean, I can understand how they want it to feel resolved, but they don't know. And we're never going to know as it carries on this way and through keeps dragging it out in this way.
Yes, actually, we got a Twitter question recently with somebody asking why it seems that families of victims always seem to buy into prosecution theories of how crimes happened and who committed them. And why do you think that is?
Because it's the worst moment of their lives and they're desperate for any hope or answers they can have.
Also, I imagine the prosecutors provide order. They provide order and knowledge and information. And you want to hope that they are competent in what they do and that they're the good guys working on behalf of justice.
Yeah, and this is something, John, I know you donated your proceeds to the Jeff Deskovich Foundation in a prior episode. One thing that he always talks about is there's not enough victims' advocates out there. Those are individuals who exist who are supposed to be neutral outside of the litigation process who can help the family and the victim if they're still alive through the process. But those are sort of few and far between, and that's something where I think additional funding to have that neutral party who really can be a shoulder and support for a victim and the family is essential.
Yeah, John, I love that you do that. It's really opened my eyes to so many different avenues to reach out to people and help.
Well, I did not know that there were so many organizations that were doing this. I had heard of the Innocence Project. Obviously, they're very high profile. But I didn't know that there were so many on local levels, you know, and they're all doing this for – they're not doing this for the money, that's for sure. So I just wanted a moment to highlight them. Guys, we got to get to episode 7, actually. But before that, I want to take a moment to thank the folks that sponsor the show and let you hear some words from them. Here they go.
You know what's been the coolest part of having Blue Apron as a sponsor for Undisclosed? It's seeing the pics that y'all send us on Twitter and Facebook of the delicious Blue Apron meals y'all are making at home. You've effectively become competitors in the Undisclosed Blue Apron cook-off, and by my estimation, y'all are whipping up on us. The meals look delicious. You're doing great. And we encourage you to keep sending those pics because Blue Apron is awesome. If you're cooking with Blue Apron, you know that you're using beef that's raised humanely, chickens that are free range, and pork that's raised naturally. You're building strong family bonds, and you're spending less than $10 per person on a healthy, delicious meal. So what picks can we expect from you for the remainder of the month of August? Well, I know on the Blue Apron menu this month, we've got spiced pork burgers with goat cheese, their summer vegetable and quinoa bowl, and finally the chicken tinga tacos with summer squash. We can't wait to see those picks or picks of the other Blue Apron meals. You know, Blue Apron has a great variety because they create new recipes weekly and they're not repeated within a year. So keep sending us those picks and don't forget, check out this week's menu. If you're new to Blue Apron, you get your first 3 meals free. It's easy. All you got to do is go to blueapron.com/up. UP, that's Undisclosed Podcast. You sign up using our promo, you get the first 3 meals free, and you get free shipping. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. And you're going to love sending us the pics after you do. So again, all you got to do, go to blueapron.com/UP. Blue Apron, it is a better way to cook.
And we are back. And in episode 7 of Undisclosed, Unusual Suspects, we looked at many of the suspects that the police had in the case of Isaac Dawkins. And at first, it appeared that the police considered Paul Allen a suspect, but they later pivoted to Joey Watkins. Just a curiosity, did the Floyd police investigate Paul Allen, or were they all about Joey Watkins?
The Floyd police never looked back. It was always going to be Joey and whoever else they needed to make a case against him stick, because he needed an accomplice. He couldn't have done it himself. So, I mean, they had no choice but to find someone else to charge. But the police kept the pressure on Paul. The Floyd County police didn't just let Paul walk away. They were at his house, at his work. From talking to him, it sounds like a dozen times at least, pressuring him. And eventually, he's the one that comes forward with information from Josh about how Joey did it. Now, the information that he gives is actually, they don't ever use it because it's obviously just rumors and hearsay, but they just needed that break to make the arrest. And that happened because they kept the pressure on Paul through those 10 months.
Now, the Josh you're mentioning is Josh Flemster, who was a friend.
Josh Flemister, yes.
Flemister, yes. Okay. Now, I feel so terrible because it feels like if you didn't have a person like Brienne in your life and this Josh Flemster character, things might have gone so wildly different for Joey Watkins. Am I right?
I think so. I think it's hard, and you never know what the but-for causation is looking back on a case. But without Brienne and without Josh, I think it's very unlikely that Joey's in prison today.
Well, because it appears that Josh was for some reason, deciding to be an armchair detective and trying to somehow set off Paul against Joey by telling either one that they were responsible for Isaac Dawkins' death. And it appears, by the way, from you talking with Joey, that he was doing some amateur investigation himself. He was recording conversations with Paul, which, of course, obviously points to him not being guilty of this crime, because why would he investigate a crime that he supposedly committed?
To me, there's very much a Salem witch trials thing happening here with these kids who are playing games about something so serious. And yet to them, it's like gossip and rumors. And he said this to me and I'm going to get you at the McDonald's parking lot. And, you know, I mean, I think that's part of being a teen is you don't recognize the consequences of the stories you tell. But God, it just really, it took away so many years of this guy's life. And it all seems to be about gossip and innuendo.
There's at least 2 other times from the case file where someone came to the police with a totally bullshit story and saying, oh, so-and-so confessed to me. They did it. And of course, it turns out to be that the person who says they got the confession had some other reason for wanting to turn the person in. But it's not just the ones we talked about in the show where this happened. And after I just said that I think without Josh and Brienne, this wouldn't have happened, I think I have to take that back because it would have happened. It would have happened a different way. Because if the cops hadn't gotten to Josh or found a Josh, they would have found another friend. And Joey did have a few friends in his life that were more vulnerable. They were in a position where they couldn't resist police pressure as well. They were struggling. I think eventually one of them would have caved. If not Josh, someone else would have.
But don't we think the police's influence and their determination to go after him was so clearly motivated by, I mean, I'm just guessing, we haven't gotten to episode 8 yet, but seems to me there's a lot of relationship with the family that seemed to encourage them to really pick one guilty party and go after it.
Oh, yeah. I know one of Joey's friends, a guy named Adam Cagle, he has since passed away, but I think he could have been, or they wanted him to be the Josh figure who goes around accusing everyone. And he ended up sort of packing up and leaving Rome, which is probably the safest play to do. But I think they would have kept going until they found someone or someone's. And that's what they did do. They just kept going for 10 months till they finally got enough people, enough snitches, to make a case.
Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Using a proprietary blend of cotton, beechwood modal, and lycra, their fabric expands naturally for 18 hours before it's cut. The result is more breathable, with a softer feel and more consistent fit. Mack Weldon promises their products will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants you'll ever wear. I have to say, as a customer, I completely agree. I have pairs of their boxer shorts, pairs of their socks. It's the most comfortable clothing I've ever worn, especially during the hot Columbia summers. But you don't have to take my word for it. Right now, you can go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code UNDISCLOSED. They want you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they'll still refund you, no questions asked. Again, that's MackWeldon.com, and you can get 20% off using the promo code UNDISCLOSED.
So in episode 7, we go through the many avenues that the police went down searching for the guilty party. There's the Kingston Bypass shooter cases that you mentioned. There's Elizabeth Loco Lambert, Stanley Brummett, and Joseph Boyd, and eventually Heath Wilson. And in each of these cases, there are reasons that the police stopped investigating. But all of these things, in listening to the podcast, seem pretty tenuous. It always seems like we're basically leaving it up to the police to decide when they stop investigating. And I think, you know, as a listener, I think, you know, gosh, I wish they had investigated things further. But is it fair to expect that of the police? You know, they have limited resources. Is it completely left up to the detectives how deep they search?
I think that's totally fair. What should also be required, though, that this be a public record. They're not allowed to do this and then not ever reveal what they did not do. If they make a determination that this lead is not a good one and they want to cease pursuing it, that's great. They're going to have to do that 100 times a case. But that should be documented and part of the record.
Yeah, we talked about a case first season. It was the case of Sabian Burgess, and that was the case where the actual killer of the victim was it Burgess's wife or girlfriend, was one of the two. And Detective Ritz, the same detective from Anand's case, took that confession. He determined it wasn't reliable, didn't pass it along to the defense. And then years later, it turned out this person actually committed the murder. And that's, I mean, Susan hits it exactly, which is to say, yeah, I mean, it's up to the police what leads they want to investigate and not. But if they're given a lead, unless they can 100% rule it out, that needs to be something the defense is aware of so they can use their own resources and look into possible alternate suspects.
Got it. So you're saying that it is unreasonable to expect that police can investigate every possible detail of things. But if at least they're transparent, those things can be investigated by others?
Right, yeah. I mean, they have limited resources just like defense counsel, just like prosecutors' offices. But right, if you get a lead, if a preacher comes to you multiple times and says, my neighbor confessed to killing my guineas and also killing Isaac Dawkins, even if you can't find something to corroborate that, that's something where you need to tell the defense. And eventually someone finally did that. Look, here is someone who has good standing in the community and they've given this story about killing the victim. We can't corroborate it, but we'll give it over to you. And if you want to investigate it, so be it.
Is there any specific criteria for detectives? You know, I don't know what they go through at the academy, but has anybody created an actual investigative methodology for this?
Well, I think it's probably department by department, right? And I mean, my husband is a detective, but I know that they spend 6 months in the academy training, and there's all sorts of ongoing investigation training that they undergo. I don't know that to be true in Rome.
Well, like, for instance, in the case of the Kingston bypass shooter, it seems like the reason they ruled that out was just geographical distance, that they felt that it was a little too far from the highway to possibly have had anything to do with Isaac Dawkins' death. Well, that seems completely arbitrary. You know, serial killers strike all over, you know, and the geographic location, we were talking, what, 7 minutes away, 8 minutes away?
6 minutes.
6 minutes.
But
okay.
Also, what bothers me the most is like, okay, maybe it's not part of the Isaac Dawkins murder, but you got some crazy shooting at trucks on a highway. Like, let's
exactly.
still look into this.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is this completely normal in Georgia?
Like, why is no one still, like, I don't even care if they were 1,000% certain it had nothing to do with Isaac. Why did no one follow up on this? There was someone right. shooting at cars on the right. highway, for right. sure.
Well, I think, Susan, you brought up that it might have been kids on the highway throwing things at cars. And that, I believe, is probably a fairly common occurrence. Shootings, however, and, you know, in one of the witnesses, she claimed that she absolutely knew it was a shooting, seems absolutely alarming. But, you know, police officers have to look through this fog of information all the time. You know, they get reports of incidents all the time. I imagine your husband, Allison, sees all kinds of incidents happen and they have to pick what they reply to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, especially somewhere like Los Angeles, you know, there's going to be a tremendous difference in reaction and how what they can handle and when. And obviously they strive to do the best they possibly can. And I want to believe that of everyone who chooses to go into that profession. But unfortunately, like everyone else, they're human, and you find the ones that are valuable to you, and or you the ones your sergeant tells you you have to pursue and or not to walk away from. And luckily, in TV, it's very different when the ones that are fancy and drama filled we get to follow up on. But the part that boggles my mind is, like you said, Susan, the safety for the people who are driving around on the freeway, and whether it's a crazy kid with a shotgun who's just trying to shoot at cars or someone who is really seeking to kill people on the road. I don't know how you don't follow up on that. And then, and the method of that being a way of murdering Isaac is still mind-boggling to me, that that would be sought out and intentional to kill him in that way.
I just, looking at this, the amount of stretching you have to do to make it an intentional killing, nothing about this, I mean, obviously someone shot a gun and I mean, it's still intentional killing in terms of the law, but the idea this was like a planned,
premeditated. Yeah.
Yeah, like a plan. No one intentionally kills someone this way.
It's a
not
terrible
like planning
plan.
Out days in advance.
It's a terrible plan. Yeah. Can you explain a little more simply for me which things you get to bring up as the defense as to what a possible other suspects there could be? Because it did seem that there were rules about when you can introduce someone else as a possible potential suspect or person of interest, or when you're not allowed to do that. And I didn't understand the difference.
Yeah, and it really is a blurry line. Georgia essentially says you need evidence directly tying this alternate suspect to the crime to be able to present to the jury this alternate suspect is someone else who could have committed the crime. And that's a fairly high standard in terms of what exactly is required. Other states would allow just for circumstantial evidence, you know, evidence that maybe the person had a motive or maybe evidence that showed that they were in the general area. But Georgia is basically saying, you know, without evidence that directly ties this alternate suspect to the murder, you as the defendant cannot present evidence to the jury that someone else could have committed the crime. Whereas it's weird in that sense because the prosecution is allowed to rely upon all sorts of circumstantial evidence to prove a defendant's guilt. And it's a bit of a double standard in Georgia, I think, of how high they have that standard set.
And I do understand you can't just go around accusing random people just to muddy the waters. But would a preacher, for example, who says that someone confessed to them be a reasonable tying directly to the crime type situation if they had done?
Yeah, I mean, that would be. In this case, obviously, the state did not turn this over before trial, and therefore they didn't have a chance to argue that this should be presented. But absolutely, the preacher saying, my neighbor Joey Boyd confessed to this would be enough. But there's a lot of things in Georgia that wouldn't be enough. Stephen Avery making a murder in Wisconsin, that test in Wisconsin is there evidence that shows a legitimate tendency that someone else might have committed the crime? And again, that's sort of fuzzy with the definition, but that in Wisconsin, for instance, allows for much lesser evidence to allow you to present a theory of an alternate suspect. In Georgia, yeah, I mean, the preacher would be enough, but there's lots of cases, I think, where that standard is set too high.
Yeah, a legitimate tendency? To me, tendency sounds like something you do repeatedly. I don't understand that use of language at all.
Me neither.
The actors chime in. The actors
don't
get it.
How do I pay that?
Yes, exactly. I got nothing. I got no clue.
Well, here's the definition. The legitimate tenancy test, this is from the opinion of Court of Appeals of Wisconsin, asks whether the proffered evidence is so remote in time, place, or circumstances that a direct connection cannot be made between the third person and the crime. So, I mean, that's still a bit nebulous, but I think we far too often preclude defendants from presenting this alternate suspect theory.
But very often defense attorneys will present it in very subtle means. It's like in the O.J. Simpson case when they brought up the Colombian necktie aspect, you know, the idea being we're inferring that this could have happened a whole other way. Is that a tactic that defense attorneys use a lot?
Yeah, I mean, they could say this looks and has all the markings of a road rage killing that randomly happened when maybe he cut someone off. That would be fine. It's the pinning it on a specific individual where the courts have a much harsher test for doing that type of direct association.
Of course, the investigation is done by the cops themselves, and the cops obviously decided the current defendant's one who did it. So trying to get this information out of them at trial, you're probably not going to be able to do it. So either you need to have the resources to conduct your own complete murder investigation, which that doesn't happen. Like 1 in 100 defendants can do that, or else you're out of luck. Because all the cops have to do here is get in the stand and say, we looked at Heath, but we ruled him out. Okay, the jury's going to believe that.
And to your knowledge, did Joey's defense attorney bring up the possibility of road rage in this incident?
They tried to bring up Heath. The cops get up there and say, nah, he was busy across town doing another shooting. He didn't do it.
Yes, he was busy shooting other people. That's, yeah.
The exact same time of this shooting, he was doing another shooting, so we know he's innocent.
With the same caliber bullet in a similar-looking car about 10 miles away.
And seriously, a few inches, and the other driver would be dead, too.
Oh, it's crazy.
Now, I wanted to get to some Twitter questions because there's actually one that pertains to this last thing you mentioned. We've got one from Nikki Burkhart Brooks, who says, okay, 1999 wasn't the friggin' dawn of computer land, but what is it with all these handwritten logs for 911 calls? Minutes, even seconds, matter so much in this case. Why in the bloody hell weren't the computerized time-stamped 911 calls pulled? Maddening.
Good question. Yeah. I wish I had an answer.
Yeah, it's military time, too, which I don't know about you, but it always trips me up. Like, I see, like, 2020, and I think 1020 immediately, but it's not. That's 820. So you look at these times, and it's, like, 1919 or something, and I think it's very easy for people to make mistakes on that.
Yes. Another question that we've got is from @AttorneyRoss, who says, after the cops linked Wilson to the second shooting, couldn't Joey's lawyer have tracked down Wilson's car?
Yeah, but the cops are up there saying he didn't do it without really explaining why. And the jury just hears the cops saying, we looked into it, didn't check out, the end. They knew what the car was. They knew that. It's just they were at the mercy of the handwritten time logs. Because no one pulled the computer records.
And because of Georgia's specific law saying you can't present another possible suspect for this without proving that they're somehow connected, that he couldn't present that?
No, they were allowed to. For Heath Wilson, they were able to. It just they lacked any means to effectively do so. And they never did basic steps like freaking calling them out for not getting the 911 computer records.
Okay, so we've also got a question from Karen Moses, who says, what is a guinea fowl? I'm from Georgia, and I have never heard of it. Does anybody know?
Yeah, they're like, I guess like a chicken is the closest comparison, but they're not chickens. They're a different animal entirely. They're small, sort of black and white checkerboard, and they're not totally domestic in the way chickens are. I remember when I was growing up in Atlanta, we had a guinea fowl that lived, I think, for like years. It just lived in the neighborhood. It was cool on its own. It flew away. It was fine. Which is why Joey Boyd was upset about his roosters, because although the guinea fowl are pretty small, a rooster is a domesticated bird, and the guinea are going to take him on every day.
Oh, okay. So he was protecting. Yeah, it was unclear to me why somebody would shoot somebody else's guinea fowl, as they say. You know, in New York, we just didn't do that kind of thing. But it makes sense in the context of protecting your own livestock. That being said, to then add, oh, by the way, I shot a guy recently, it seems a little odd as a justification. You know, it's like, I'll shoot anything. I'll shoot anything around. around in terms of Joseph Boyd's confession. It sounded to me, again, you know, getting back to Detective Mosier making the decision not to follow up further on that particular thing, it did sound to me like he was bragging, like if in fact this was said, he was bragging about how tough he was. You know, the context of it didn't sound like a truthful confession.
Yeah, I mean, I took it a different way in terms of the way that I read and listen to what was said. And Susan, I don't know if you agree, but I thought what the preacher was saying was that Joey Boyd was coming clean. He was saying, I sinned by shooting your guinea fowl. And, you know, you as a preacher, I'm also seeking absolution because I'm going to admit to you that I also shot that Isaac Dawkins boy. That was the way I took it, what the preacher was passing along, as opposed to boastful taunts almost by Joey Boyd.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Being boastful, but
yeah, it didn't sound like that to me. It sounded like they were in the midst of sort of an argument. I don't know if that's when I would seek absolution.
But the way the state portrayed the Joey Boyd thing is totally disconnected from the actual facts of the matter. Joey Boyd lived about 0.3 miles from where the shooting probably occurred. He was super close. He was like basically one of the closest houses you could possibly be to the shooting. And of course, they try and play it off like 1 to 2 miles. And a lot of the facts, they argue it at the hearing, post-conviction hearing, that, oh, how could Joey Boyd have possibly shot the truck from 2 miles away over hills? Well, no, that's never what Hudgens really is saying. He's just saying the guy confessed, not that he did it from his house.
Yes, it seemed like an odd thing for an actual court document to cite. You know, it seems like they're looking for reasons, no matter how tenuous, to reject it at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of the inertia of the court system. And that's what's tough, is oftentimes appellate courts are looking for any reason not to reverse a conviction or a sentence. I mean, there was the recent case that the Supreme Court just overturned, the Chapman case, where you literally had a prosecutor putting a B next to the African-American jurors' names and engaging in racial discrimination. And Georgia Supreme Court found that that did not violate the Constitution. Of course, the Supreme Court just reversed it. But it's tough to get a conviction or a sentence overturned in Georgia. They are not very eager to find fault with what happened at that initial trial.
So the next question was from at Kala Odem, who says, are we going to talk more about Josh? What's his motive for having Paul and Joey point fingers at each other? And a possible suicide attempt? And I'm just going to continue this question just because it gets really cool for me. It says, by the way, obsessed with how you guys are rolling out season 2. John Cryer is great, and so right on how you are changing the way people view freedom and justice in this country. Thank you. Okay, I had to finish that. But let's get back to Josh. What could possibly be his motive for setting off his friends this way?
I mean, Josh is a complicated figure, and he's acted on different motivations different times. But at the start of it, at the core of it, I think Josh just wanted attention and was just saying things to get attention, and it got way over his head.
There's also a possible reading of events that he's actually legitimately trying to figure out who did this. You know, again, I tend to generalize about people in these particular stories because I don't know these people, and, you know, you kind of need a handle to hold on to who they are. But they're people, and he could well have had good reasons for what he was doing, but he hasn't had a chance yet to explain himself.
You do kind of identify people in your mind, or I think you mentioned earlier that juries do this too, and I don't know how you not do it, but like I said earlier, and I've thought it from the beginning, Brianne is the character I understand, and I certainly feel it explains a lot to me. But again, that's such a hypothetical thing in my own conclusions based on my life. And is that fair, and is that the law? No, I don't know. I mean, what is the change in our justice system to make it more about innocent versus, like Colin said, Georgia, just protecting the conclusion that's already been drawn? I mean, I don't know.
You bring up Brianne. I think she's a good sort of example of what happened here a lot, because there's a lot more going on with Brianne and her stories, which are the case files, we're talking to witnesses. It's pretty clear there's more going on here. But at trial, what the jury gets to see is a very, very limited window of the world. They get to see what the prosecutors decide to put in front of them, and to a lesser extent what the defense does. And the jury never saw any of that. I talked to one juror who told me, I asked her, like, what shall Brianne's testimony? And she commented, Brianne was so much meeker and milder than I expected. As in, like, she thought maybe that since she was dating a hothead, crazy psycho like Joey, maybe she'd be a little bit hotheaded too. But she just remembered being kind of surprised about how mild Brianne seemed. And I'm like, oh,
but that's
performance,
not
the word
too.
I'd ever abuse for Brianne.
Okay. I mean, if you're not unless it's on TV, once again, like the performance you give on the witness stand, unless a defense attorney is really breaking you down or trying to get to the truth or providing other side of that story. It's how you put yourself over. And if you're good at that, I'm sure you could do a lot of persuasive testimony, right?
Well, or even if, by the way, you're not good at that. Like, I remember when I was serving jury duty, a defendant who was a crack addict came in and was incredibly quiet. He was scared just to approach the microphone and speak. And, you know, that somebody with that particular addiction problem, you know, I grew up during the height of the crack epidemic in New York City. And, you know, you have a bunch of ideas about people with that particular problem. And this guy was shy and inhibited and not at all the people that I'd run into on the street. And, you know, I was sort of swayed just because of who he was, just that what he presented was so subtly different than what I had expected. I imagine that happens all the time, not even on purpose. I imagine, you know, perhaps Brianne was nervous about giving testimony. And so she was seemed quiet and demure in that situation. Perhaps.
Could be true. And we have no way of knowing. It's like the article Colin cited in episode 3. Depending on who you talk to and what view you have of Brianne, we can't know her motivations. We can't know her thoughts. And it looks different however you view her. I will say there is one photo in the case file that I was confused about for a long time. And it's just Brianne sitting on a bed. And she looks like she's crying, kind of. Like her eyes are red and puffy. And she's talking on the phone. But she has a big smile. And she's pointing at the phone, like laughing. And it's a weird photo, and I was confused by it. And someone, I was talking to someone later, and they mentioned it. Well, what happened was Brianne was on the phone with Joey, and she was trying to be upset to, like, make him think that she was crying. So she was making herself cry while talking on the phone. And then a friend snapped her picture of her, like, laughing at what she was doing at the same time.
Wow.
Trying to, like, deconstruct Brianne is a, I don't know, it's a task that I'm like a podcast can do.
The interesting thing about Brianne in particular to me is the tone of voice and the way she represents herself to the police in those interviews, at least, you know, what you hear in their voice and how that differs from what the juror that you spoke to discusses how she was on the stand. I mean,
yeah.
The impression I got was of
a... She doesn't sound meek and mild in those interviews.
No, she sounds like a well-spoken victim. You know, she's very clear about how she's been victimized. And for all we know, she may well have been. I don't know for sure.
And they had to proceed with that understanding. I mean, I totally understand that they had to move forward with her story the way it was heard to them. I get it.
Well, not necessarily. Because remember that Rome police didn't seem to find her credible. They didn't. They never had a formal interview with her. They don't seem to rely on her. It's not till Stanley Sutton and Floyd County gets in that they start using her stories as the basis of a lot of what they're going to do at trial. So to me, and I can't say that this happens, again, I can't read into the detective's minds either, but looking at the Mosier files from the Rome Police Department, it does not seem that he found what Brianne was saying to be credible.
It seems that Detective Mosier comes at this from a different angle. He seemed to dismiss things at a certain level, like, again, the Kingston bypass shooter, the Elizabeth Loco Lambert's story. There's no definitive line. Like, as you were telling the story, it becomes apparent that Sandra Stocks, the woman who accused her of confessing to the crime, may well have had an ulterior motive. But we don't know that for sure. Apparently, Elizabeth said she had an alibi, but it's not proven, at least in his notes, that he followed up on it or was certain of it. So again, where is the line where police stop? You know, I think it's unfair to expect them to go to the ends of the earth for every possible lead because some of the leads probably seem stupid to them. You know, I mean, they're human beings.
And some of them were stupid here. That was certainly true. There were some stupid leads. But Mosier, he did not have a one-track mind. He did not have the tunnel vision that's so characteristic of wrongful convictions. But like, if he got a lead that was remotely plausible, he's like, yeah, I'll check this out. But then he just stops. And I'm not really clear why. Like, with Heath Wilson. I mean, someone said, hey, he was busy doing another shooting. Mosier says, cool, and closes the books on him.
Yeah, it's remarkable. So, Allison, do you have any last questions for Susan here?
Yeah, I mean, is this still an ongoing investigation? Are you still talking to people in Rome? Or is it what you are reporting to us week by week? Something you've already sort of gotten to the end of the season in your mind. Do you know where this ends?
No, it is very much an active investigation with like new updates by the day. And I would love to hear from more people in Rome. I mean, even if you think that nothing you know is important or relevant, I can't even count how many times I've had a witness start off by saying, nothing I know matters or can help, but here's what I know. And halfway through, you're like, this is huge. Why'd you think this didn't matter?
That's a great...
So seriously, if people out there know anything, get in touch. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes, and actually we got a Twitter question from @LoriClaire who says, is it possible to have a brief recap of Joey's legal situation and what's needed moving forward, new evidence, etc.?
A minor miracle.
Because he's exhausted all of his legal possibilities at this point?
He needs new evidence. He needs... Joey is at the end of the line. I mean, it's to the point where without extreme evidence, the system does not care if Joey's innocent unless he can prove it by overwhelming odds. So that's why the investigation still goes on and why we are, I think, just starting this thing.
Well, thank you guys. And I have a million days of our lives questions that I'll get to on another podcast.
Can we do like a soap opera version of like, yes, Joey's case? I mean, it kind of already is.
It totally
is. Someone called
it
like a Southern Gothic soap opera. I'm like, yeah, that kind of sums it up.
All you need is the music and like fade to blacks on the cliffhangers. You guys, you have it. It's happening.
Well, thank you, Susan. And thank you so much, Allison. This has been another great episode. And I'm so grateful you guys could make time for it. So here's the part of the show that I really love. Every week, this is where I get to highlight an organization that's helping the wrongfully convicted. And it's a chance for you to get to know the people and organizations that are doing the real grunt work trying to keep the justice system honest. So this week, it is the Midwest Innocence Project. Now, it's dedicated to the investigation, litigation, and exoneration of wrongfully convicted men and women in Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Nebraska, and Arkansas. Now, recent studies conservatively estimate that between 2% and 5% of all inmates in America are innocent of the crimes for which they were convicted. This means that somewhere between 2,000 and 7,000 moms, dads, sons, and daughters are locked behind bars this very moment for crimes that they did not commit. The MIP staff work diligently to give freedom back to those whom the legal system has failed. And thanks to their partnerships with law schools at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and Columbia and the University of Kansas, their presence in the classroom gives them the opportunity to teach the next generation of lawyers and investigators how to identify and prevent these injustices. And I want to thank Jennifer Flannery for bringing this organization to my attention. And as you know, fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #JoeyWatkins or #JusticeForJoey. And if you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use #UDAddendum or you can tweet them directly to me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, if you've got any worthy organizations for the wrongfully convicted that you would like for me to consider donating to and highlighting, let me know that as well. Oh, and as always, there will be new case documents and photos posted weekly at undisclosed-podcast.com. Now, every week when I listen to the podcast, I get super sad when it's over. But then I remember that there's new documents online, and I get all excited again. Oh, and I wanted to bring up that Rabia and Dennis Robinson are hoping to do a panel at the South by Southwest Festival about podcasting for social justice. But in order to do that, they need you to vote for it at the South by Southwest website. And that website is panelpicker.sxsw.com/vote/67597. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project at GA Innocence. I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy for once again doing a bang-up job making me sound like a real human being. I want to thank Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for audio production as well. And of course, thank you, Patrick Cortez, for composing the new addenda theme. And Methil Telhan, who is actually ailing. She's not feeling great this week. So I want you to send out your good vibes to Methil, who is our project manager, and thank her for doing such a great job. And I'll be back next week. So I'm not going to let Dennis Robinson run away with this show. Okay? I'm just putting that out there. He, unfortunately, was very, very good. He actually sounds a little bit like me, which is almost creepy. But he did a great, great job last week. And it's good to know that should I fall ill or am assassinated for some reason, that Dennis is there to jump in. But barring those two possible scenarios, I will be back next week. And thanks again for listening this week.